Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a bit of a battle space of the war for the free world on Election Day, the day we choose, the day that will make all the difference, perhaps, in the future direction of the United States. And today we are going to be focusing on what the stakes are, the importance of the choice before us, and, of course, the importance that each and every one of us do our civic duty by casting ballots to make that choice. Joining us to begin our review of what's at stake in the security policy portfolio specifically is our friend Roger Noriega, our duty expert on hemispheric affairs. He served as Assistant Secretary of State under President George W. Bush, with responsibility for that portfolio, also was responsible as the U.S. permanent representative to the Organization of American States for managing our relations with our friends in Latin America. And Roger, I wonder if you could sort of give us a big picture here as to what, as you see it, the stakes are with respect to U.S. relations in this region. How important is it? And based on what we've seen of President Obama's record and what we've seen of candidate Romney's positions, might be the differences with respect to this particular very important region.
Well, when President Obama was elected, this is a guy who'd never even traveled to Latin America in his adult, ever in his life. We knew that he didn't care about the region. We didn't realize how careless he would be toward the region. Under his watch, you've seen the Iranians establish a beachhead in Venezuela, hosted by the anti-American government of Hugo Chavez. Hezbollah is wherever Iran is, so we see Hezbollah operations right here in our hemisphere. And then also turning a blind eye to the narco state that Venezuela has become. The other thing is the sort of missed opportunities. Governor Romney has made trade, particularly with Latin America, the number two plank in his five-point plank to create jobs in the United States. Obama sat on a couple of trade agreements with the region, including with one of our best friends, Colombia, and sort of ceded that market to competitors in Canada. So American farmers lost out and all of that. But back to the security threat, his fundamental, most important responsibility is to keep us safe. And I think he has, at the very least, turned a blind eye to what's happening in Venezuela, which threatens the lives and well-being of every American.
Well, you're being generous, of course. He actually said that Hugo Chavez was not a threat. So he really is sort of not only turned his own eye blindly in this direction, but encouraged everyone else to ignore it. Give us very quickly, Roger Noriega, a sense of what Hugo Chavez is up to that makes him a threat, and whether you sense that Mitt Romney has a better appreciation of the dangers there than does the President of the United States.
Well, that's a very good point. In July, President Obama said that Venezuela wasn't a threat, and Romney immediately pounced on that. He's paid close attention to what Chavez is up to, which is using this petrodiplomacy to undercut U.S. influence in Latin America, and then, worse yet, rolling out the red carpet to Iran, China, and Russia, and all of this led by the Castro dictatorship, which runs the intelligence apparatus in that country, and then also allowing Hezbollah to train, to raise money, to plan operations in Venezuela right here, which will have an impact right up to the American border with Mexico. So that's the really acute threat that we're confronting, and President Obama has made it very clear that he is negligent on this issue, and Governor Romney has made it clear that this is something that he sees as a threat that the American people don't yet know about and you know, from which he wants to keep them safe.
Yeah. You mentioned, Roger, Mexico, and how does that fit into the equation in terms of what the next president of the United States is likely to confront? They've just had a leadership change there. They have an ongoing, very violent war with drug traffickers. We have illegal immigration on the border, including, it appears, people other than Mexicans who are passing through Mexico and coming here with potentially very malign intentions, not simply seeking economic opportunity. Give us a sense of how important that is likely to figure, that part of your portfolio in Latin America, in the next president's watch.
Well, it's extraordinarily important because Governor Romney has sort of looked at North American energy independence. He's looked at the trade relationship on the upside, you know, prosperity for the American people, jobs for the American people, getting immigration under control by letting the Mexicans stay in their work in their own economies. And the other vision is one of negligence, where the Venezuelan narco state has been allowed to sow mayhem in the form of cocaine trafficking up through the Central American isthmus and in Mexico. And I think the Mexican government has gotten sort of bum rap, but you can't imagine how terrible the problem would be for us if they hadn't taken on these narco guerrillas, these narco syndicates, the way they have. We need a government that will take that. We need a president who will take this threat seriously and partner with the Mexicans to confront this problem, and then also on the upside, deal with our economic future.
Let me turn, if I can, to this question of trade, Roger. I have been struck, we've talked about it in the past, that Governor Romney has indicated that if you take the market and the exports we have to the region, Latin America, in which you have, of course, specialized over your career, it really is comparable to and may well in the future exceed that of communist China. This has, as you've indicated, together with the energy security implications of a prosperous and very vibrant relationship between the United States and the region, the potential to really quite substantially transform our trade as well as economic security posture. Does the president have a clue about this as you see it? And is this one of the really stark choices that we're likely to face in today's election?
Well, like most leftists who do Latin America, they see these as mendicant, aggrieved countries, not economic partners. Romney sees it differently. He has an entrepreneur's eye for this and sees the opportunity. But all we get from the Obama administration so far is this sort of patronizing attitude, and they really don't see it. We can build an economic future with these countries. Brazil is one of the fastest growing economies. They're going to be building a middle class there for the next 30 or 40 years. The United States exporter has to have an advocate to make Brazilians interested in American products just as the Mexicans are. That is a fundamental economic relationship, and it's being totally missed by the current administration.
Let me turn to Cuba, Roger Noriega. And again, our guest is the former Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs. You have spent many years thinking about and contending with the various problems and threats emanating from Fidel Castro's government, now that of his brother Raul, but still under the Castro team's management. Mary O'Grady had a very interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal earlier this week talking about the hardship wrought by Hurricane Sandy on the people of Cuba and the real indifference of its of government towards them. Robert Zubrin, a colleague of ours at the Center for Security Policy, has written that prosperity is the best means of addressing this you know, natural disaster phenomenon. Very quickly, Roger, is the next president likely to have to contend with the end of the Castro dynasty, and how best to do that? Do you think it's more likely to be managed well by Romney or by Obama?
Well, so far, Obama is making unilateral concessions to the Castro regime, even though they've taken an American hostage in the form of American aid worker Alan Gross. Authorizing remittances and tourism to Cuba that will generate hard currency for that regime. So I think they're looking for the soft landing strategy. Really, the building block is the rule of law. That drives prosperity, and that, obviously the Castro regime is not interested in the rule of law, and so its people will continue to suffer until we have a purposeful policy to promote a change where the people of Cuba have make decisions about their own future. So far, we have a policy that's utterly indifferent to that, and it has to change. It's written in U.S. law in the form of the Helms-Burton legislation that we support a genuinely democratic transition.
We need to be doing that, and let us hope that the next president will have the wit and the mandate to do just that. Next up, one of the most stark choices. Will we maintain a nuclear deterrent under the next presidency? Straight ahead.
Do you see that doggy in the shelter?
Hi, I'm Buddy, that adorable puppy you adopted from the Humane Society.
Meow. I'm Whiskers, a fluffy kitty, just waiting for someone to love me.
When you adopt a pet, we hope your new furry friend will become a cherished member of your family. And as Buddy and Whiskers will tell you, the key to success is following the rules to love by.
Woof, that's right. Please give me food, water, and exercise every day. To stay healthy, I need the same kind of things you need.
Talk to me. I like hearing your voice.
You're my best friend. Please don't stay mad at me or lock me up as punishment. Remember, I'm probably going to live 10 to 15 years, so take care of me when I get old.
One day you'll need someone to take care of you, too.
A message from the Montgomery County Humane Society. Visit www.mchumane.org for the complete rules to love by.
Be your best friend for life.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Congress doesn't have a budget for 2011, but the GOP has proposed a budget for 2012, and Bill Bennett likes it.
Maybe it helps to have that 2012 in the background, people hearing and seeing Ryan and the Republicans saying they're serious about really cutting the budget
as a backdrop
to this debate about 2011. People make the decision, well, Republicans seem much more serious about this.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by one of my most admired and longest-serving colleagues. He is Dr. Mark Schneider. Mark is a senior analyst with the highly regarded National Institute for Public Policy. But he has served for many, many years in a variety of capacities throughout the U.S. government, developing and bringing to bear extraordinary expertise with respect, most especially, to nuclear deterrence, what it takes to maintain it, and the challenges that we're facing to both the quality, the reliability, the safety of our deterrent arising from the threats emerging around the world, as well as decisions being taken by our own government. And Mark, this brings us to the question of this election. We are, of course, speaking as some people have yet to vote. I want very much to encourage you to talk about the stakes with respect to the nuclear deterrent of the United States inherent in this election, by maybe starting with the president's thinking about the necessity for deterrence, and then we'll get into some of the challenges that whoever is going to be president for the next 4 years will face.
Well, President Obama, routinely proclaims that he's in favor of a robust nuclear deterrent, but his policies are not really consistent with the declaratory policy. If I had to sum up his nuclear weapons policy, it's some form of minimum deterrence. It's clearly a situation in which his a long-term announced goal of eliminating nuclear weapons is driving the numbers down, and the numbers are driving strategy rather than what it should be, strategy driving the numbers. In terms of modernization, we are really doing very little. Essentially, we have a 20-year moratorium on any significant modernization of our forces. No announced commitment yet to continue the nuclear triad beyond 2030, and an announced policy, if sequestration goes into force, to essentially degrade every element of deterrence, but most significantly eliminate the ICBM force completely, very quickly, eliminate the program for a new nuclear-capable bomber and restart it notionally in roughly 2025.
Trust me. In 2025, that's forever. Mark, you've written about this very lucidly in a new piece entitled "The Triad's Uncertain Future" in the Journal of International Security Affairs. And I guess what jumps out at you, among other things, is that as the president is pursuing this this goal of ridding the world of nuclear weapons, starting with ours, no one else seems to be following. How much of a problem does that represent?
It represents an enormous problem. Both Russia and China have very extensive modernization programs underway, and they've both announced a policy of actually expanding both the quantity and the quality of our nuclear weapons. We're doing exactly the opposite. We have all sorts of restrictions imposed on our ability to improve our capabilities in any significant way, and you have the president's announced goal reiterated earlier this year in a speech at the Nuclear Security Summit in Korea of going to lower numbers than allowed in the new STAR treaty that he signed in 2010 and was ratified in early 2011.
Let me just drill down on something here, because, Mark, you've talked about the triad, and I think most of us are familiar with the land-based ballistic missiles, long-range, intercontinental-range ballistic missiles, typically in silos. We've got bombers, as you mentioned, dual-capable bombers, but with some residual capability, at least some of them, to deliver nuclear weapons. And we've got submarine-based missiles. You've described how under sequestration we may have to give up one or maybe even two of the legs of those triads, the triad, and reduce the number of submarines against the backdrop of these rising threats. It's a very ominous thing indeed. But spend a minute here, Mark, talking about the condition of the nuclear weapons themselves that would be delivered, if God forbid we ever have to, by these any of the legs of the triad that survive. What is the condition of the weaponry itself? Has it also suffered from now 2 decades of erosion by design?
Certainly, it has. We haven't tested a nuclear weapon in 20 years now. Our Cold War arsenal.
Wait a minute. Stop. We haven't tested a nuclear weapon in 20 years?
20 years, yeah.
You mean we have no certainty that these things will even work after 20 years?
No, not in – not. I mean, physics is an exact science. You do physics by doing experiments, and a nuclear weapon's the ultimate type of experiment is a detonation of the weapon. That's been precluded. We haven't done it for 20 years. We have introduced life extended versions of the weapons we have, which have many changes in them. And the question of whether they will work or not, nobody really knows. I mean, it's really closer to medicine, a medical opinion, rather than physics, which is, you know, an actual test.
Guesswork is another more uncharitable way of describing it, I guess. So this is a very ominous thing, and is the industrial base that supports all of this healthy despite these changes? Can we rapidly rebuild if we need to the delivery systems or the nuclear weapons? If a new president comes to office and says, you know, we can't persist in this this essentially atrophying of our nuclear deterrent capability?
The answer is no. Nuclear weapons infrastructure is decrepit and broken in some key respects, as Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said in 2008 in a speech before the Carnegie Institute. We are the only of the five declared nuclear powers that can't produce new nuclear weapons. We simply do not have the technical capability to do that. And I would like to add something on the issue of testing. Other potential adversaries, have tested covertly nuclear weapons in the last 20 years. I mean, there's an extensive literature on this in the Russian press, declassified CIA reports. Both Russia and China have apparently covertly tested nuclear weapons at low yields. And that's in the U.S. Strategic Commission report. It's in the analysis I did of the New START Treaty. It's entitled New START, the Anatomy of a Failed Negotiation. You can get it on the NIPP website for free. It's got an extensive write-up on that issue. And that's a very serious problem.
It is indeed. And I guess basically, Mark, just in wrapping up, what you've described here is a frightening reality that most voters, most Americans, for that matter, are oblivious to. And that is that at a moment when the world is becoming considerably more dangerous and there are more, not fewer, countries that are getting into the nuclear weapons business, perhaps Iran next, that will trigger further proliferation, we have every reason to believe. We are unilaterally disarming this country's nuclear deterrent capability, arguably the most important single element of our defense posture. Mark, we have to let it go at this, I'm afraid, but I think you have helped, particularly with this very important new piece about the triad's uncertain future, you make clear. This is arguably as important as any decision we are making in electing the next commander-in-chief. Will we persist in going down the road Barack Obama has set, which is allowing this deterrent to essentially erode away, if not actually dismantle it by actively doing so? Or are we going to take steps to make sure that we have the capabilities to deter aggression against us and our allies that the nuclear forces have represented?
Hey, parents! Finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi, son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, I'll fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. This is it. Not D-Day, but E-Day. The day we determine via an election the direction of our country for the next 4 years by choosing the man who will guide it as our next president and commander-in-chief. It's a choice I encourage you to make, and make carefully, by doing your part. Cast your ballot. As you do, I hope you'll factor into your decision two questions. Are you safer today than you were 4 years ago? And just as importantly, if present trends continue around the world, will you and your kids be safer 4 years from now than you are today? You can help determine the answer to rising threats from Islamists, Chinese communists, and assorted other enemies, and the hollowing out of our military now underway. Please, be sure to vote. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedomradio.com.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement? And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
I'll pick you up after school. Okay, I got it.
It's easy to take a day for granted. You and your family are connected by routine, and you stick to it. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if life as you know it has completely turned on its head? What if your day's routine is disrupted, and you can't reach your family? Have you planned for that? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, it's up to you to be ready. Get a kit. Make a plan. Be informed. Today. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Ready.gov. This message brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Admiral James Ace Lyons, a remarkable man who has served his country in uniform for close to 40 years, rising through the ranks to four-star admiral and commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet back in the Reagan administration. You may have seen him yesterday on Fox News. He has been writing lucidly and with great effect in the Washington Times now for many years and continues to serve his country, I like to think not least, through his service as chairman of the Military Committee of the Center for Security Policy. Admiral Lyons, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's always great to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Frank, and to be able to talk to your listeners.
Well, we're glad to have you do it. We were just talking with Dr. Mark Schneider about the really deplorable condition of our nuclear forces. And I wondered if you might, particularly with your expertise in the United States Navy and as a commander of American forces in the Pacific, give us a sense, as you see it, of the condition of the military more generally. We have a new commander-in-chief, perhaps about to be elected, certainly a choice in commanders-in-chief. What's at stake, as you see it, for the armed forces and for our security?
Well, in fact, we need to look at the last several years here. Our military has been run hard and put away wet.
That's an old cavalry expression, I think, and we're not in that business anymore, Admiral. So it means that it's not in great shape, I guess.
That's exactly correct. And in fact, in the Navy's case in particular, we are headed for the smallest Navy we've ever had since prior to World War One. Not World War Two, World War One. Somewhere around 200 plus ships. And to put that number in perspective, when I was Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet, I had 255 ships under my command.
Just in the Pacific alone.
Today, the entire Navy, we have something somewhere around 280 ships.
Now, Admiral Lyons, as you know, and I mentioned that cavalry bit because the president responded with a quip to Mitt Romney when he was making this very point about the size of our fleet by saying, well, we don't have bayonets and horses anymore either. He was essentially saying because our individual ships are so much more capable, it doesn't really matter that we have significantly fewer of them. As a guy who's actually been in the business of operating fleets, what do you say in response?
Well, first of all, it just reflects on his lack of knowledge of military background. You know, the globe hasn't shrunk. The world hasn't gotten smaller. No matter how effective a ship is, it can only be in one place at one time. And let's face it, we're being challenged. We're being challenged by China in the Western Pacific with a double-digit, massive military expansion program with no known threat, and certainly particularly in their naval expansion program with their anti-ship ballistic missiles, their modernized nuclear submarine force, their power projection capabilities. All of this must be addressed. You can't sweep it under the rug. Bayonets and horses don't cut the mustard.
Right. Admiral Ace Lyons, I was talking with Mark Helprin, who, as you know, is one of our brightest strategic thinkers, and he made the observation, both in a Wall Street Journal piece and with us recently, that let's just say for the purposes of discussion that a contemporary ship is today 100 times more capable than a ship of pre-World War One vintage. But if that ship is sunk, it's the equivalent of losing 100 ships in today's world. And what you've just said about the Chinese building up their capabilities, of course, it's worth noting that they're particularly building up anti-ship capabilities seemingly very much designed to attack and neutralize our naval forces.
That's exactly correct, Frank. And we also should recognize we cannot lose sight of the fact that Russia is modernizing their forces. They've gone on an expansion program as well. And not to be overlooked is the fact that Iran, through all its machinations, has established bases in Venezuela, not just army and their Hezbollah bases, but missile bases, which have been, when activated, can target a number of American cities, which right now we have no defenses for.
These are emerging threats that unmistakably will confront the next president of the United States. And your assessment, Admiral Ace Lyons, and evidently that of some 500 of your former comrades in arms, is that Mitt Romney is far more likely to be able to contend with them with the approach he's taking. He calls it modeled after Ronald Reagan, peace through strength, than is likely under an Obama administration and sequestration cuts that are in the offing if it has its way.
There's no question. If sequestration goes through, you are gutting the military. You are inviting our potential enemies to become more aggressive and threaten the freedoms and security that we enjoy today.
Admiral Lyons, let me quickly turn to something you were speaking about on Fox yesterday and have been writing about very, very well in the Washington Times, and that is this whole Benghazi gate business. In part, I think it's fair to say that the lack of response to the attack on our embassy may bespeak some of the concerns that you're talking about, both with respect to leadership and with respect to the size of our forces. But what else should we know and think about as, again, we're reflecting on who to elect to be our next commander-in-chief today?
Yeah, well, in this particular case, first of all, as I said previously, this attack should not have come as a surprise to anybody. The Brits and the Red Cross pulled out of Benghazi in midsummer because of the deteriorating security situation. On 16 August, the consulate sent in to the Department of State their assessment of the security concerns, in which they said, quote, "We cannot defend this consulate against a coordinated attack." They identified 10 Islamic militias, well-armed, affiliated with Al-Qaeda, who were running wild in eastern Libya, and who had no fear of government retribution because the government had lost all control in eastern Libya, and in particular Benghazi. We had the Blue Mountain security manager, who the Department of State contracted with to provide the security for our consulate, on the afternoon of 11 September, sensed something was wrong and put out an alert on his two radios and cell phones that there's something amiss here. And then he apparently had a falling out with the 17 February
Martyrs Brigade,
which was assigned the security for our consulate, who happened to have a close association with the Ansar al-Sharia militia that actually conducted the attack. This is all mind-boggling. While the attack was going on, the calls and the video feed were coming direct into not only the Pentagon, the Department of State, but the White House. And what did our president do? After he did basically nothing. He ignored the calls. In fact, what he did, he went to bed so he'd be well-rested for his fundraiser the next day in Las Vegas. The director of CIA went to a movie. We know that 3 hours before the attack, roadblocks and checkpoints were being set up by Ansar al-Sharia militia. We know that the Turkish consul general had to pass through those roadblocks and checkpoints for his meeting with Ambassador Stevens at the consulate. All of this calls into question President Obama's fitness to be commander-in-chief of our great military forces.
This hurricane season, coastal residents in the southeast and the Gulf states are urged to prepare for the uncertain conditions they may encounter in the aftermath of a major storm and make their annual contingency plans. In addition to other emergency essentials, the American Red Cross and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security recommend residents keep a diversified emergency wallet that includes cash and traveler's checks. American Express traveler's checks provide an extra measure of financial safety and security. Keeping traveler's checks and a supply of cash in small bills offers storm victims payment options to make necessary purchases. Traveler's checks never expire, providing a secure payment method whenever emergencies occur, this year and in the future. Unlike cash, they're refundable if lost or stolen. American Express traveler's checks are available at banks, credit unions, and American Express Travel Service locations across the Gulf Coast and Southeast regions. For more information, please visit www.americanexpress.com/travelerschecks.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces, in the war of ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Is Nancy Pelosi looking to a higher power to get a balanced budget? Hugh Hewitt sets her straight.
When I hear you speak about this issue, of course, it's the Gospel of Matthew. When I was hungry, you gave me to eat and listen to the Gospel.
I just got to stop here. Nancy Pelosi quoting the Gospel of Matthew, as though that's got anything to do with the government. Let me just tell you, it doesn't.
Can I get an amen?
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined, and it is a distinct pleasure beyond words to say this, by a much beleaguered and greatly valued friend, Andy McCarthy, who is still without power as a result of Hurricane Sandy's predations 8 days afterwards. Andy, I just can't tell you how much I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us about the stakes in this election, but one that I know you have very much top of mind is what America is like without power. And I'd just like to mull with you, if we don't do something to make considerably more robust our electrical grid, we could conceivably face the kind of situation you've been experiencing for the past week, for a year or more, as a result of an electromagnetic pulse attack or cyber warfare. How bad an idea would that be?
Oh, it would be, you know, look, Frank, we have to hope that we're going to have more power than 10 minutes every Tuesday, which is pretty much what I feel like I'm down to at the moment, as happy as I am to speak with you. But all kidding aside, this really is a deplorable situation. And I think a real, to quote our current but hopefully not too much longer incumbent, I think it's a real what you would call teachable moment, because we spent almost $1 trillion on stimulus. And we were told a whole lot of things about shovel-ready jobs and how it would at least addressing America's
infrastructure situation would have, you know, great long-term economic benefit. And what it appears has happened, and I don't see how you get around this, is we've had, you know, we basically spent $1 trillion, which was a pass-through to President Obama's base, and didn't address at all our infrastructure, which remains deplorable. I mean, if you think about what we're going through here in New Jersey, it's because in the, you know, in the cutting edge, most free, most important, most dynamic country in the world, we have an antediluvian electrical grid.
Right. Very vulnerable to disruption, not by just tree branches and other natural disasters, but of course also man caused disasters, as they say. Andy, you've written.
I'd say Oval Office caused disaster.
Well,
but that's just me.
There's that too. You've written brilliantly on many, many subjects over the years, but I think you've written as beautifully as ever I've seen about your experiences in Hurricane Sandy and what it says about our country and the way people are responding. I really commend to everyone your piece about the aftermath of Sandy on National View Online. Andy, much more to cover with you. Let's talk quickly about the stakes this election day and a couple of other areas that you've, again, addressed extraordinarily well. President Obama has made a policy of engaging, I would argue, legitimating, enriching, empowering, emboldening the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamists. How does that look today from your perspective? How's it working out, in short? And do we need a course correction with respect to this idea, both overseas in places like Egypt and Libya and Turkey and so on, but also here at home?
Well, Frank, I think unfortunately it's gone about the way many of us predicted it would go, and that is that we have empowered enemies of the United States, and we're seeing the wages of it today in particular in what really it understates it to call it the scandal over the killing of four Americans in Benghazi, which I have written I think is an impeachable offense, and that is not going to go away regardless of who wins the election. But, you know, you can't empower enemies of the United States and make the world safer for anybody. And I think, you know, we're seeing that with the stranglehold that the Muslim Brotherhood is now getting on the Middle East, which can only increase its already proven ability in the United States to punch way above its weight. If you consider the, you know, the population of, or the percentage population of Muslims in the United States, it really is a dangerous situation for us both domestically and certainly overseas in a region where we have a lot of interest in the world.
Yeah, and again, I commend everyone the writing that you've been doing on this, not only at National View Online and Pajamas Media, but also your terrific books, including the most recent one, Spring Fever, which is all about this, as well as, of course, Willful Blindness and the Grand Jihad. Andy, in your previous incarnation, you were a federal prosecutor. You put away the blind sheikh. You have shared with us your concern on this program in the past about the possibility that the president of the United States, Barack Obama, whether he's reelected or not, may well yield to the demands of the Muslim Brotherhood, specifically President Mohamed Morsi of Egypt, to release him. How serious a threat does that represent? And what do you think Governor Romney, should he become the new president-elect, might do to prevent that?
Well, I think, unfortunately, Frank, number one, as we've talked about before, I think that the President Obama will release the blind sheikh. The fact that he never made a full-throated denial of any intention to do so, I find foreboding, especially, you know, under the circumstances we're in, where, you know, especially in the aftermath of Benghazi, he would have had a political motivation to at least appear to be taking a hard line with Islamists. That would have been a pretty propitious time for him to make a full-throated denial if he was going to do that, and he hasn't. And as far as Governor Romney is concerned, you know, I'm afraid that, number one, there's really nothing anyone can do about it if President Obama, in the 11 weeks between Election Day and Inauguration Day, if he decides to release the blind sheikh, there's not anything really that Governor Romney can do about it. And I imagine that Romney will take the position that traditionally is taken, which is that we only have one president at a time, and he may condemn an action like that from the sidelines, but there really, as a practical matter, isn't anything he can do about it, and he certainly isn't going to want to appear to be weak.
Yeah. And how serious a threat is it if the blind shake is let loose, Sandy McCarthy?
Well, look, he's a guy who has commanded violence from his jail cell, so it's not like he's it's not like he's under lock and key now, but certainly if he gets out of jail and he's able to operate, you run the risk of a Khomeini type situation in Egypt. And that's not to say that he doesn't already have some competition for that, because I think we have Sheikh Karadawi to worry about as well. But Karadawi appears to be pretty safe in Qatar, whereas I think they're going to roll out the red carpet for the blind sheikh in Egypt if he gets to go there.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. Andy, a couple of other quick questions. Lightning round, as they say. The prospects for a Guantanamo Bay closure and what that might mean under a second Obama presidency?
Well, I think there will be a Guantanamo Bay closure even if Romney wins. I think that, again, in this 11-week period that we continue to talk about, because nobody's really focused on it. Understandably, everybody's focused on the election. But, if the president has laid the groundwork for closing Gitmo by buying this white elephant prison outside Chicago, and I imagine what could happen, I know that there are supposedly laws in place. I say supposedly because laws haven't stopped President Obama from doing anything that he's hell-bent on doing up until now. And if he puts all these guys on a plane, and lands them in the United States, out of Gitmo, who's going to do anything about it? Certainly not a law that's going to stop them from doing that.
Yeah, and what we're going to find, I suspect, is that they get kid glove treatment in our court system, and who knows, maybe released
into the United States. Yeah, those of them who get into our court system. The problem is a lot of those guys are at Gitmo precisely because they can't be tried, because the evidence that we have on them is intelligence information that would require the giving up of methods and sources that we can't afford to give up. And unfortunately, while they're at Gitmo, that's one thing. Once they're in the United States and they're being held without trial, you can just imagine the federal judges, a number of them, who won't be too happy with that situation.
I can indeed. Andy, we got 30 seconds. Supreme Court, how important is it in this choice for president?
Well, crucial. I think the next... we have at least four judges, I think, who will be 80 or over in the next couple of years. And it's very likely, given age and health reasons, that the next president will probably get two Supreme Court picks, which will really control what the balance of the court will be probably for the next generation.
Wow. I can't imagine higher stakes among the others that you've mentioned so well. Andy McCarthy, thank you as always for joining us, especially under the difficult circumstances in which you find ourselves. Our prayers are with you and all of those in New Jersey and the Northeast who are still struggling in the aftermath of this storm. I hope we will learn from this teachable moment, and I hope we'll make the right choices in this election. Thank you for joining us, folks. I look forward to talking with you after the election is complete. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Affney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.